Pittsburgh next. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am so excited to welcome back into our studios, I think for the first time in 2017, Kate Jerome, who is an instructor in the horticulture department here at Gateway Technical College. And Kate typically joins us two or three times over the late spring, summer months to talk about various issues that you might find yourself contending with in terms of your lawn or your garden. And so she's also here on the eve of one of the biggest sales here at Gateway Technical College involving the horticulture department, a sale this weekend that involves native plants. We have a couple of those things to talk about. Lots of questions have already come into me via Facebook and email, and we'll be opening up our phone lines in a few minutes in case you would like to talk to Kate Jerome. And of course, that's really the best way to pose a question to Kate, although it's not always handy, but if it is handy for you to give us a call, that's the great way to do it, because then Kate can perhaps ask you a follow-up or two and really clarify exactly what your situation is and the best way to help you. Kate Jerome, we welcome you back to the morning show.
It's great to be here.
Thank you for coming, and we'll open up the phone lines in just a few minutes. I want to make sure right off the bat, before things get too busy, to give you a chance to talk about these two events that are coming up. And ahead of that, just say a quick word about kind of the dimensions, the scope of the horticulture program here at Gateway Technical College. What does the program sort of look like? What does it offer in general?
Well, we offer anything to do with plants, basically. We have several different areas of focus. You can focus in landscape, which would be design management. We also focus on greenhouse and garden center management, marketing. We have floral design, and we have a thriving urban farming program. So we kind of cover a little bit of everything.
How big a faculty?
We have three full-time faculty and one horticulture specialist who work with us, and then we have adjunct faculty that also work with us.
Right. And it sounds like the kind of program where some of your students are making a concerted effort to start and go through and finish, I mean, in kind of orderly fashion, and then you have other students who kind of drop in and drop out according to their lives and their particular interests, right?
We do have a wide range of students. We have the 18-year-old who's straight out of high school and comes and does the associate degree. Many of our students will do both areas of focus, the landscape and the greenhouse, and because it just means a couple of extra courses, and they'll come out with two areas of focus. We have people that are coming back to retrain for a new career. So we have 45-year-olds that are in our classrooms. We have people that come back for lifelong learning. So I'll have a 75-year-old in my classroom. And it gives us a really nice mix because everybody benefits from everybody else's experience. And it's a really interesting type of classroom.
Wonderful. Let's talk about the two events that are coming up within the next few days. In fact, one of the events is later today and into the early evening.
Yes, we have our farm market today at 4 o'clock, and it goes until 8 o'clock. We will be featuring fresh produce from the from our farm, and we also have some hydroponic systems that are going in the greenhouses, and they're producing cucumbers and tomatoes and things that you can't quite get yet.
Mm.
And we will offer, we have fresh eggs, we have local honey, and we do offer garden clinics every other week. This is the off week, but next week we'll be featuring herbs, and the clinics are a free demonstration and an opportunity then to make or do whatever I was demonstrated and purchase the materials from us. So it's a nice opportunity to, you can come just for the clinic just to see what's going on, but you can also have a chance to get your hands dirty.
Mm. Very good. So that's today, 4 to 8.
4 to 8 at the Pike Creek Center. Just come onto campus back toward the greenhouses and you'll see it.
And that's the Kenosha campus of Gateway.
Right.
And then explain what's going on Saturday, something quite exciting.
Saturday is our big blowout plant sale. It will be happening from 9 to 2, again, at the Pike Creek Center. And we have the horticulture department, is all of our plants are for sale, all of our flowering plants, baskets, containers. And we are thrilled to have as partners in this sale the Wild Ones, and they will be there selling their native plants. So we have two sales going on at the same time, and it's kind of chaotic and it's a lot of fun, and there's a huge selection. The Wild Ones offer herbaceous plants, but they also have some trees and shrubs and a few ground covers, and we have all of the flowering plants, so you can do a complete landscape.
Mm, wonderful. So, and if time permits, we will take a little time later in the hour and talk about the rich benefits of native plants, because it's something that we've talked about from time to time in the morning show, but that's something that always bears repeating. It's so important that we think more about including more native plants in everything we design, right?
Yes, absolutely.
In the meantime, we want to start posing some questions to Kate Jerome. That is your questions. And if you would like to give us a call here at WGTD and go on the air with Kate Jerome, our phone number is area code 262-564-8450, 262-564-8450. You can also, if you prefer, send an email, and we'll give you my Gateway account email, which is my last name, B-E-R-G, and my first initial, G, so B-E-R-G-G, at gtc.edu. GTC, of course, stands for Gateway Technical College. So one more time, B-E-R-G-G, at gtc.edu. So feel free to send me an email, and I will pass your question on to Kate Jerome. And as I said, we already have quite a number of questions that have come in from various listeners interested to get Kate's expertise. So go ahead and give us a call, send us an email, and enjoy the next few minutes. Kate, question number one. What kind of tomatoes, I think, what varieties of tomatoes, I think that's what we're talking about here. What kind of tomatoes grow best in pots?
Oh, this is one thing that we're actually focusing on this year. We have several different varieties that are specifically designed for containers. And, of course, I won't be able to remember any of the names of them, but most of them have, there's one called Tidy Rose. They're designed specifically to use less root space, so you can put them in a smaller pot, and they don't need trellising. They don't need a big support system. They just make a little shrub, and they make tomatoes all year long. So anytime you purchase a tomato, make sure that it is a patio-type tomato or that it has a compact, determinate habit. That's a lot of words, but compact means it's kind of tight, and determinate means it reaches a certain point and stops growing.
Ah.
If it's indeterminate, which a lot of the heirloom tomatoes are, it will continue growing, and you have to support it. You have to have a trellis for it. So you want to make sure
because it'll get too tall
and it just flops. And I mean, you can grow them without a trellis, but then they start growing on the ground and making a mess. So in a container on a patio, you want compact, you want a patio type, and generally they're smaller tomatoes. You're not going to get beefsteaks in a patio type tomato because those big beefsteak tomatoes take a bigger plant.
Mm. So in order for that big fruit to be produced.
You're right. It has to support it. So generally the fruit will be smaller cocktail size tomatoes or cherry tomatoes usually. But there are a lot of them out there. This is the big breeding area this year. So a lot of breeding is going on to develop these container type tomatoes, eggplants, peppers, all of them are being bred so that you can grow them in containers.
Mm. So in other words, there's big increasing demand for them.
Oh, absolutely. A lot of people are downsizing their living space, so they're downsizing their gardening space. And these you can grow on a patio.
Wow. Very good. Another question from a listener in Racine. Would raspberries work in a raised bed? Would raspberries work in a raised bed? And if so, do you have any advice?
They would definitely work in a raised bed. Raspberries are very tough. Growing them in a raised bed might curtail their tendency to run because they send out suckers and they run, so you have to control that. Growing them in a raised bed might control that a little bit, but I'm not sure it's going to stop it by any means. As with anything in a raised bed, you just have to make sure that they get plenty of water as they're developing their fruit, and raised beds dry out faster, so you just have to monitor a little bit more closely.
Very good. If you have a question for Kate Jerome, please send me an email at bergg@gtc.edu or give us a call at 262-564-8450. This is a question from Ellen. When lawns are mowed, some people leave the grass clippings on the lawn and say they are good mulch. Others mow the lawn so the clippings end up in a bag. Which is the best way to mow the lawn? And is the guy who is mowing my lawn simply lazy by letting the cut grass remain on the line?
On
the lawn.
That's a subject that's close to my heart. Gentleman who is mowing your grass is doing you a favor. He is not being lazy. He leaves those grass clippings, they're actually fertilizer. So it's free fertilizer. Removing the grass clippings from the lawn basically sterilizes things and serves no purpose. It makes it look neater. The only time that grass clippings really need to be removed is when they're really heavy. We've had a lot of rain and the lawn gets really long. And if there's a lot of grass clippings on the lawn, then where they lie, they can leave yellow spots. So in that case, yeah, you want to either rake them up or just kind of move them out. But otherwise, definitely let them fall. It's less expensive to mow because you're not having to haul that grass away, and it is free fertilizer. It does not cause thatch, which is a problem that a lot of people are concerned about. It's that kind of brown, dead material at the base of the grass plant. Mm. I think if they'd leave their clippings, that's what causes thatch. It does not. The grass clippings.
People believe that, but
right.
It's a mistake
it's
to believe that.
It's a mistake to believe that, right. The grass clippings are mostly water. They will disintegrate, go away, and feed your lawn. Mm. So you definitely should let them fall.
Leave them there. Leave them there. It's 23 minutes after 8 o'clock. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD, and Kate Jerome is here. She's from the Horticulture Department here at Gateway Technical College, answering your questions about the lawn or the garden. And you can call us at 564-8450 if you would like to go on the air and speak directly to Kate Jerome. Otherwise, email your questions to bergg@gtc.edu. Okay, Kate, here is a question from Holly. What are the best shrubs to take clippings from to root new shrubs? And maybe ahead of that, explain a little bit about what she's asking about there for someone who's not ever done that before.
When you want to propagate your shrubs, in other words, start new shrubs, there are basically two ways to do it, two times of the year that will dictate when it's done. One is the first type is softwood cuttings, which are done usually in June. Softwood cuttings are the new growth of a plant, and you want to wait until it's not when it's really, really soft as it just starts coming out, but until it's hardened off just a little bit, it's gotten a little bit tough, say toward the end of June. That's when you would take softwood cuttings. The other time to take cuttings to propagate shrubs would be in the wintertime, and these are called hardwood cuttings, and you take them when the plant is dormant. Different shrubs do well at different methods, and this is something that you're going to need to do a little bit of research on to find out which shrubs do best with softwood or hardwood. Softwood cuttings take a little more care, and you have a little bit more loss usually, just because they're very succulent. Hardwood cuttings take a little bit longer to establish, but they're usually a little bit more successful. So just about any shrub, you can take cuttings of just about any type of shrub. Dogwoods, of course, are one of the best. They root very easily, and they'll even root in water, which is usually not recommended, but they're very tough, and you can take either softwood or hardwood cuttings. But otherwise, you can take cuttings from lilacs, from spirea, from just about any of them. But look it up first and see what is recommended. In most cases, you're going to need to purchase rooting powder, which is a hormone that helps the roots establish faster and better. And you can pick that up at any hardware store or garden store. It's just called rooting powder.
Rooting powder. I've never heard of that.
It's basically a hormone that stimulates root production. Okay. And if you don't use rooting powder, it takes the plant longer to establish those roots, so you run more of a risk of the cutting dying before it roots.
And this is something especially important with doing this with shrubs?
Right. With shrubs, you can trees are a different matter because trees grow in a different way, and you have to be specific as to where you take the cutting from on a tree. If you take it from old growth, mature wood, it will not take. You can't go to the tip of an oak and take a cutting and assume it's going to take. It won't. So taking cuttings from trees is an entirely different matter. And I suggest you come take one of our classes and we can teach you how to do that.
There you go. What a great idea. I like how you snuck that in. Very good. All right. Great, great, great. Here's a question from Michael, who's actually from Northern Illinois. Michael asks, how do you get grass to grow in a lawn that has a river birch that is sucking up all the water? The roots come up too close to the surface. And then he finishes, I'm assuming the only answer is more water. So first of all, can you explain what he's talking about and what in the world is a river birch and what makes it so nasty?
Well, a river birch is one of those plants that its native habitat is along a riverbank, so they thrive in a moist condition. They don't necessarily suck all the water out, but any tree is going to compete with grass, so it's hard to get grass to grow under. And river birch, in particular, has roots that are more closer to the surface. Let's say that. So so it will take some of that surface water. Whereas an oak, the roots are a little bit deeper, and they'll take deeper water, so they don't compete quite as much with the grass. There, aside from more water, which is basically going to drown your grass, which you don't want either. The only thing that I can suggest beneath a river birch is that you either mulch or you put in a different kind of ground cover. Grass is, you're always going to fight it. You're never going to have really good grass under a river birch. So pull that mulch circle out to the edge of the crown, just fill it with mulch and then grass on the outside and you'll be good.
So in other words, it does not make sense to try to grow grass underneath a river birch.
Right. It's just they're going to compete no matter what. And there is not a grass unless you go to a wetland plant like a sedge that will actually grow well. And even then you're risking it. So just put mulch down. Mulch is good.
Mulch is good. It's 8:28. We're listening to you're listening to The Morning Show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. And with us today, right here from Gateway Technical College's Horticulture Department, is Kate Jerome, answering questions that have been posed about the lawn or the garden. You can add your question to the mix by emailing me at berggg@gtc.edu. Someone's done that. Great. Or you can give us a call at 564-8450, 564-8450. Area code is 262. Kate, we got more questions here. Let's keep going. This is from Heidi in Racine. She asks, besides hydrangeas, what bushes grow well in shady spots?
Oh, that's a hard one. If you want a flowering plant, that's not going to do. You're going to have a hard time. Generally, the dogwoods, viburnums, all grow quite well in shade. They're larger plants, although there are some dwarf dogwoods out there, and they will grow in shade. But they're not grown necessarily. I mean, they have flowers, but they're not necessarily grown for their flowers. They're more grown for foliage. As far as flowers, the only one that I know that flowers pretty well in the shade is one called Caria. It's also called Japanese Caria. It's K-E-R-R-I-A. It grows very well, does a beautiful job of flowering with yellow flowers. There's one that has variegated foliage that's quite attractive, but it's not easy to find. So you'll have to do a little searching to find that. But otherwise, you're going to have to stick with the foliage plants, the viburnums and the dogwoods, because they do quite well.
I'm going to skip ahead to a question that's somewhat related. Here's this is from Kari in Racine. Will hydrangeas grow under evergreen? We lost our signal for a second. I think we're back. The question was, will hydrangeas grow under evergreens?
Yes, they will. They'll do just fine. They actually do fine with a slightly acidic soil, which is what you find under evergreens, and they do well in the shade. As long as you make sure it's the type of hydrangea that grows in the shade. There are some hydrangeas that need full sun, and in that case, they won't do well. Hmm. So check it out as you're shopping.
Very good. 8:30, this is the morning show on WGTD. Our guest, of course, is Kate Jerome, and we are posing all kinds of interesting questions to her about the lawn and the garden, and you can add yours to the mix by calling us at 564-8450, or you can email me at bergg@gtc.edu. Okay, now this one is a little more complicated, so let me make sure I pull this this up. This is from Patty. Patty writes, we moved to our downsized empty nester's place in the country between Madison and Milwaukee 2 years ago. She used to live in Kenosha, not far from here. And I am trying to establish lots of perennial areas in our yard. So here's question number one. What are the best perennials or combinations to plant for all summer color and blooms? I already have daylilies, Asian lilies, peonies, bearded irises, a variety of hostas, tulips, and lavender. These would be for a front flower bed with full sun. I want flowers that will take off and come back each year very full. I was hoping for plants that would be between 1 to 3 feet tall.
That's a tall order to ask because there are so many things out there. Boy, I don't even know where to begin. Coreopsis is a good one that blooms most of this summer. You're not going to get something that's going to bloom all summer very easily. You're going to have to do a sequence. And so you'll have some that are summer bloomers and then some that start late summer and then go into fall. I suggest sitting down with a good perennials book and starting to just to make lists of when things bloom, because I think you're going to be disappointed if you try and have the same thing blooming all summer long. It just doesn't work that way with perennials. With annuals, yes, and that's also a great way to keep that color going, is to tuck some annuals in your perennials, and that way they go all summer long. It's an expense, but you don't have to use very many, but just some annuals that do keep that color going all summer long. And then sit down and write a sequence. I mean, there are many books that are written that will give you recipes on how to put the sequence together. But it depends on sun and shade and size and exposure and all kinds of different things. So I'm not sure I could just give you a recipe, a magic list.
Yeah.
Right. So it's going to take a little bit of research.
Right. Good point. Question two from her. I have tried cone flowers that were really colorful, but they didn't come back the next year. Am I not planting them deep enough, or are these just finicky for overwintering?
The cone flowers with all the different colors besides the standard purple are finicky. Sometimes they'll come back, sometimes they won't. And there are some beautiful colors out there, but they're unfortunately not really reliable yet.
Hmm. Question three, I'm also looking for winter hardy rose bushes and am not able to find any for sale at the places I have looked thus far. They have plenty of roses, but they say they are non-hardy.
Roses, most of the roses that we think of, the Floribunda roses and the tea roses, are not hardy. So they need to be protected, and you need to go to great lengths to make sure they get through the winter. However, if you look at landscape roses or species roses, that's the right way you want to go. They're actually called landscape roses, or it'll say species rose on it. They're grown on their own roots. They're not grafted, which is a huge difference, because these others that don't make it through are grafted, and you're protecting that graft, that union. So if they're grown on their own roots, you don't have to worry about that. So one of the greatest series of roses that have been created in the last few years is the Knockout Rose, and it comes in reds and pinks and all colors now. It's just called Knockout, and there's a whole series of them, and they're perfectly hardy, perfectly sturdy, and they grow. In the most cases, they grow not more than about 3 feet tall. And they bloom all summer, so that's a good thing.
Very good. And she finishes with not a question, but kind of a thank you for you. She writes, by the way, we are still going strong with our vermicomposting with the worms you gave us initially. Between the compost we mix into the raised beds and the compost tea, we have plants that are growing very, very well. So she thanks you for the information. Just say a quick word about what she's referring to there.
Oh, that's absolutely wonderful. Composting with worms is a fun thing to do. It's also very productive for your garden. It's a slow type of thing. To compost with worms takes about 2 months to get everything composted, but you can feed all of your kitchen waste to your worms and keep them in the kitchen for that matter. And we do occasionally, I'm actually doing a clinic later in the summer on worm composting and showing you how you can build your own bin, and you can also purchase commercial bins, of course. And then we sell worms at the farm market, so get you started. Tell you how to do it and get you started.
So worms can be fun. You heard it here. 8:35, this is the morning show on WGTD. Kate Jerome is with us, and you can call us at 564-8450 or email us at bergg@gtc.edu if you have a question that you would like me to pose to Kate Jerome. Kate, let's move on. This is Lisa from Racine. we've had this before. The question is, what can I do to keep the rabbits from eating my plants?
I had that question asked of me at least once a day. It's very hard to keep the rabbits out. The only thing that absolutely works is fencing. That is the only thing, because rabbits can't come up over a fence. Squirrels can, though, so if you have squirrel problems, that's not going to work. But that's the only thing that absolutely works. Beyond that, there are repellents out there. Some people have great luck tucking human hair or pet hair in among their plants. I've never tried it, but some people say it works. You can purchase blood meal, which is at a garden store, and sprinkle it around there, which all of these things basically give a scent that the rabbits don't like, and so they don't come near your plants. Cayenne pepper sprinkled on them supposedly stops them from eating, but many of them develop a good taste for Mexican food, so they will eat the cayenne won't stop them. So it's a matter of trial and error. The best thing in the world is to get a dog to keep the rabbits out of your yard.
There you go. From the same listener, what should I do to improve clay ground?
The best thing in the world is adding organic matter to it. Don't be tempted to add sand, which is, you think, well, sand's going to loosen it up. Sand will give you concrete. That's how you make cement, is with clay and sand. So don't be tempted to add sand to it. The best thing in the world is if you can get a source of compost. Most of cities and villages have free compost available. You can also buy it bagged. Just add that to your soil. You don't have to dig it in. Just put it on top, and it will work its way down into the soil. If you collect your leaves in the fall, shred your leaves. Shred them with a mower and just blow them into your beds or into this area where you have the clay. Shredded leaves are wonderful organic matter as well. So whatever you can find, add to your soil. You can dig it in, you know, take a fork and dig it in. Don't be tempted to rototill because you're going to ruin the structure of your soil. Just put it on top and plant right in it.
There you go. Final question from Lisa. How often should I fertilize my hanging baskets?
I generally recommend hanging baskets and containers be fertilized every couple of weeks at about half strength. So whatever the recommendation is on the fertilizer that you purchase, dilute it to half that, and then do it about every 2 weeks. You can do it every week. The problem is if you over-fertilize, your plants are going to be very succulent, and then they're prone to disease. So you want to have them a little bit tough. So about every couple of weeks is good.
Interesting. And are there specific fertilizers that are designed for that?
Any general garden fertilizer is fine. If your hanging basket is filled with flowers, then you want a fertilizer that is specific for flower production. If your hanging basket has vegetables in it, then you want definitely one that is designed for vegetable production.
Very good. Question now from Denise in Illinois. With the growing concern about the bee population declining, are there certain plants that would encourage bee populations? And besides avoiding Roundup, are there any other do's and don'ts regarding the well-being of bees?
The most diverse landscape you can possibly put together is the best thing. With a lot of different kinds of plants and a lot of different shapes and sizes of flowers. And it's not just the flowers that are showy that we look at and they're gorgeous, but also the flowers that are on trees and shrubs. Flowers on maple trees are quite tasty to bees. One of the best things in the world for bees, and people don't like to hear it, are dandelion flowers. That's the first source of pollen for them in the spring, and so leaving those dandelion flowers to let the bees use them instead of trying to kill them and get rid of them is really a good thing to do. Chemical use of any kind is not a good idea. Roundup is not good, but anything where you're spraying fruit trees, anything else, the most minimal use possible is really important because just about everything can hurt the bee population.
It's 20 minutes before 9 o'clock. This is the morning show on WGTD, and Kate Jerome is with us. She's with the Horticulture Department here at Gateway Technical College. And, Kate, let's keep moving here. This is from Kathy in Racine, although not my Kathy. For those of you who know, I'm married to Kathy. This is another Kathy in Racine asking, what is the best way to keep caterpillars from devouring your kale?
There's a product called Bacillus thuringiensis. It's also called BT. We call it BT because that's a mouthful. Yeah. BT is a beneficial bacterium that you dilute and spray on your plants, and the caterpillars, when they start to munch, they eat this, and it basically kills them. It will kill any true caterpillar, so anything that turns into a moth or a butterfly. There are some other caterpillar-looking creatures out there. Most of them don't bother kale, but this will not take care of those. This takes care of only the true caterpillars. And usually the caterpillar that goes after kale is the cabbage moth, the little pretty little white butterfly with little black spots on its wings, and that's what you usually see. But this particular, it's not a chemical, it's a bacterium, will help avoid that. I think the brand that you usually see in the garden stores is called Dipel, and that's something that you can use. It's very inexpensive. The only other way to keep them off of there is to cover them with a netting or a type of row cover, and that's not as easy as it sounds because you have to make sure that there's enough rain getting through and enough light getting through. So.
Okay, very good. This is from Jill in Racine. This is a little complicated. A lot of times questions don't make perfect sense to me, and this is one of those where I suspect this will make more sense to you than it does to me. We have several clumps of intentionally planted ornamental grass, Carl Forrester grass to be specific, and I want to get rid of it because it seems to be crossbreeding with crabgrass or maybe just with normal grass, and now we have weird, reedy grass popping up all over the place. How do I get rid of it?
The only way to get rid of it is to dig it out or to use an herbicide on it. I've never heard of Carl Forrester crossbreeding, but it's certainly possible. And if it's something that you don't like, then your best bet is either to use an herbicide on it, like Roundup. You need a broad spectrum, not something that only goes after broad-leaved lawn weeds. It needs to be something that will kill grasses as well. The other thing that you can do if you have a whole area you want to clear out is you can cut it down really short with a weed whip and then cover it with cardboard and mulch, and that will choke it out.
Okay. From Wayne, when and what are the best times and methods to treat for grubs?
I assume you mean grubs in your lawn. Usually midsummer is about the time when we go after those. August, you can go all the way into August, but once you get past, say, mid to the end of August, the grubs start burrowing down deep, and whatever you use on them is ineffective. There are some bacterial grubicides, I guess, that will take care of them that you can sprinkle on your lawn that are non-toxic, and so that might be the way to go. Make sure if you have a whole bunch of grubs, then yes, you need to be concerned. If you have only a few grubs, it's not something to really be concerned about. So the best way to do it is to cut a 1-foot square of your sod, pull it back, and see how many grubs you've got there. And if you have 20 grubs, then you're in trouble. If you have 4 grubs, you're not.
Very good. It looks like we have a caller. Caller, go ahead. You're on the air with Kate Jerome.
Hi.
Hi.
Mike from Racine.
Go ahead.
And I have walnut trees, a number of them. And in my backyard near them, I have trouble growing the grass properly. What sorts of things can I do to strengthen my lawn there?
Unfortunately, because of the heavy shade and because of the competition, you're going to have a hard time. There's not really anything that any grass that's going to compete well with them. And black walnuts also have this extra little problem that they submit a toxin from their roots that kills plants. So I've been fighting one myself. I've lost several plants that I've planted near this black walnut, and I'm trial and error trying to figure out what will grow there. So your best bet is probably, again, to mulch, just to put a nice big tree circle around it and put mulch, because you're not going to get anything to really look good and strong and healthy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, another question. What do you think about Milorganite as a fertilizer for the lawn?
I think it's a wonderful fertilizer for the lawn. It's a mild enough fertilizer that you can't burn, and you can't do big burn spots on it if your spreader jumps or does a hiccup on you and drops a bunch of it. It's organic, and it's one other little nice part about Milorganite that they don't advertise is that it is a deer deterrent. So if you have any problems with deer, it keeps the deer away as well. But I use it on my lawn, and I think it's wonderful. It's not horribly expensive, and it makes me feel kind of better that it's organic.
Very good. Thank you.
You're
appreciate
welcome.
You calling. Thank you so much. And Mike called us at 564-8450, 564-8450. You can call us as well as you'd like to pose your question directly to Kate Jerome. Kate, also from Wayne, the question about how do I keep rabbits and chipmunks from eating my pepper plants? And that's, of course, the same answer as before.
Right. You can try a cayenne pepper spray. I mean, sometimes that's effective. It's a little more effective for chipmunks than it is for rabbits. But it's not. It's you have to reapply it after every rain. So, again, trial and error.
Very good. We have another caller. Go ahead. You're on the air with Kate Jerome.
Yes. Kate, I have a place where there's some ferns and daylilies that have taken over. For many years, it was okay, but they just seem to have
they keep going.
Become very active. They're the wild type of daylilies that, and they don't even really bloom anymore, and they're just very fleshy and tall. And the fern, I wish I could tell you which kind of fern it is. It's not bracken fern. It's has a leaf like a sword fern, but the plant stands up very tall.
Really tall.
And rigid.
We have a lot of cinnamon fern in the area, and it may be a cinnamon fern.
Hmm.
And it's very hard to pull, of mm-hmm. course. And well, how will I get rid of this stuff?
Well, I hate to say it, but I think you're going to need to use an herbicide because otherwise you're going to be digging until you're 100 years old to get them out of there. It's very hard. I have fern issues myself, and we dug out a bunch of them and gave them to everybody we know, and they're all back. And it's backbreaking work to dig them out. So if you really want to get rid of them, you can cut them down really low and do the cardboard and mulch trick, which works pretty well. It may not work as well on ferns because they are really tenacious. Beyond that, you're going to end up having to use Roundup or an herbicide.
Is there a way that I can, send a picture of an old rose that's just, like an heirloom or something? I don't know what it is. My grandpa planted it. It's a yellow rose. It's very thorny for you to identify.
I am not a good person to identify roses. I have actually one from my husband's great-grandmother that sounds exactly like that, and we have no idea. We just call it Grandma's Rose because we have no idea what it is. It's possible that you might go on the Internet to the Rose Society and
it
see.
It seems like a wild type of rose. I call it the Yellow Rose of Texas.
Yeah. It's roses are. The old roses especially, unless they are a very specific species, are very hard to identify. So you need someone who is a rose specialist who might be able to pick it out.
So the Rose Society might be a
the
way
rose
to go.
The Rose Society, yeah. They're on the Internet, and they may have I haven't checked, but they may have a way that you could send a picture and see if they can identify it.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Appreciate you calling. It's 11 minutes before 9 o'clock. This is the morning show, and Kate Jerome is with us from the Horticulture Department. A few more questions, Kate, from Laura. Our neighbor's creeping Charlie is spreading into our lawn. Is there a way to get rid of it?
Oh, again, you have to use an herbicide to stop creeping Charlie, one that is a broadleafed herbicide that can be used in a lawn. It is a problem. It's a problem because it gets into garden beds. It's not necessarily a problem in the lawn unless you really don't want creeping Charlie in your lawn. But I have creeping Charlie in my lawn, and it's green, and I mow it, and I enjoy it because there's no way I could get rid of it all.
There you go.
But the only thing that'll do it is you can't dig it out. The only thing is an herbicide.
From Nancy, how do you get rid of powdery mildew?
It depends on what it's on. Roses in particular have an issue with powdery mildew, and there is an organic spray that you can mix up on your own. It's actually call it the Cornell spray because Cornell University developed it. Their horticulture department developed it. It's basically take a gallon of warm water, and into that you put in 3 to 4 tablespoons of baking soda, and then you put in 3 to 4 teaspoons of oil. It can be just olive oil, cooking oil. And then you put in about a teaspoon of dish soap. And so this is giving you, the oil is in there to make it stick to the leaves. And then the soap and the baking soda actually work against the mildew. So you start spraying before you see the mildew. It does not get rid of it. It just prevents it. And you spray every 3 to 4 days. Another method that we've tried and has been very successful for us is milk. A 10-to-1 ratio of milk and water, and spray it on your plants, and we've actually had it get rid of mildew on cucumbers, which is hard to do.
Interesting. So. 10-to-1. Nancy also asks, what is the best time to transplant my clematis?
Next year. They're best transplanted in the spring and very early in the spring before they start to leaf out, so before they start their growth. So definitely wait until next spring. We're past that point.
From Mike in Illinois, should I dethatch my lawn prior to overseeding when trying to thicken up the grass?
Well, it depends on what you mean by dethatching. If you're using one of those thatching rakes, you're going to do more damage than you're actually doing helping your lawn. The best thing to do for a thatch problem is to have it core aerated, and that's where they come in with a machine that digs little cores out of soil and grass out and then drops them. That is the most effective way to get rid of thatch if you have a thatch problem. If you don't have a thatch problem, a thatch problem means that you have it about a quarter inch of that dead brown material at the soil surface. Any less than a quarter inch, it's not usually an issue. And if you don't have a thatch problem, then just go ahead and overseed. If you do, then have it core aerated first and then wait about 2 weeks before you seed.
Very good. Here's an intriguing question from Katie. To till or not to till? That is my question.
Oh, another one right from my heart. Not to till. I do not recommend tilling under almost all circumstances. When you till the soil, if you're tilling a brand new spot, that's the time that you could use a tiller. But don't think that you're going to take a tiller and just dig into grass and till up a new site because you're just going to be making a mess. So you have to remove the grass. Tilling the first time, you could certainly do it to loosen things up. But beyond that, tilling does nothing but destroy your soil. It breaks the structure down, and it makes your soil compact, makes a mess. And so I don't recommend tilling. Once you have a garden in place, the soil is perfectly happy having the plant roots do all the tilling for you. And so you don't never need to turn it over again. Once you've gotten it started, then you just plant and add your amendments or anything you're going to add to it just on top.
Very good. From Curzio. Kate, are you familiar with planting chestnut trees, starting with nuts being vernalized? I got some in November, kept in my cooler through April. It took more than 40 days to grow the taproot, and half have emerged. And he's just curious about other people who've perhaps tried this, wondering if anyone is growing chestnut trees to produce a crop.
I don't know off the top of my head of anyone else who's doing it, and I'd have to do some research to find out about the vernalization. my guess is that's what they need, because that's what nature does. Nature drops them in the autumn, and then they go through the winter, and then they will start their germination process in the spring. So I think vernalizing them was a good idea. It's something that a lot of people don't think about doing. They just collect the nuts and then they plant them. But they do need that. They need a winter. So hopefully you're successful with it. And if I hear of anybody that's starting to do chestnuts as a crop, I will certainly get in touch with you.
Very good. All right. Well, that polishes off all the questions that we received via telephone, email, and Facebook. And at 5 minutes before 9 o'clock, I want us to return to the matter of, first of all, just to remind everybody of the farm market sale, which is today 4 to 8,
right?
And then this Saturday 9 to 2, the big horticulture plant sale, which is in conjunction with a huge native plant sale under the auspices of the Wild Ones. Kate, I wanted to give you a quick chance to just say a word about why, in your view, native plants are a really good way to go. What is it about native plants that is, in a sense, magic?
Well, native plants don't take the care that our prima donna plants that have been introduced take. That first of all, they're carefree. They also work to set up an ecosystem. So it's not just the plants. It's the plants, it's the soil, it's all of the pollinators, it's all of the wildlife. Everything works as an ecosystem. So setting that up in your yard means that you have a sustainable landscape. Planting things every year is not very sustainable. So it's definitely a way to move yourself into a more sustainable situation.
There are a few things that people should be thinking about doing at this point in time, including, of course, this is the time to be planting vegetables and flowers.
It's time. It's time. Of course, every time I say that, I get frozen out. Something something happens, but it's time to do it. I'll be planting my tomatoes this week, so.
It's the time to prune spring flowering shrubs.
Right. If they need pruning, many times they don't, but if they need shaping, this is the time to do it before they set their flower buds for next year. So right after they finish blooming, then do any pruning you need to do, and they'll be set for the following year.
Speaking of pruning, this is when we prune suckers off of small evergreens.
Right. You prune suckers off of crab apples and some of the service berries, the suckers that grow at the base. And this is also the time to prune to tip prune yews and junipers. This is the time to do it when they will not be harmed they'll harden off before wintertime.
I wanted to be sure to ask you about some terminology here when it comes to bulbs. You say this is the time to prune out spent flowers. So what do we mean by spent flowers?
It's a nice way to say dead. when those daffodils are finished blooming, go in and prune out the whole stalk, but leave the foliage, because the foliage is what is feeding the bulb for next year. So until it starts to yellow, you should leave it intact. But get that flower stalk out of there.
This might be a time for herbs to be pinched and dried.
Right. Herbs are coming on strong right now. So as you're going through the summer, go out and pinch them. Keep them nice and shrubby. And as you pinch those pieces off, either dry them for winter use or use them in your cooking.
This is a time to mulch roses and to use something that came up in the course of the hour, this wonderful Cornell spray if you have a mildew problem.
Right. You want to treat for mildew. Remember that you're treating to prevent it, not to stop it after it's occurred. So use the Cornell spray every 3 to 4 days and mulch your roses in well so that the moisture is very even.
Hmm. And, of course, thanks probably to the fact that it's been such a rainy spring, we really are seeing mushrooms in our lawns, maybe even more so than we normally would, because don't mushrooms like moisture?
Mushrooms like moisture. So you see all kinds of colorful mushrooms pop up. They're usually not something to be concerned about. You can just take your foot and kick them off. And they may return, they may not return. But they're not doing any harm. It's just another part of that ecosystem.
Right. Let's remind people one more time about the two sales and maybe what we really need to do besides saying tonight, 4 to 8, the farmer sale, and then Saturday, 9 to 2, the native plant sale and horticulture sale. Explain how people can find the Pike Creek Horticulture Center here on the Gateway Campus in Kenosha.
Just come to the main campus entrance, which there's the marquee at that entrance. Come in and come all the way west. You'll see the greenhouses. There's parking all around us, and the Pike Creek Center is right in the heart of the greenhouses. So that's where the sale will be. The Wild Ones native plants will be outside, and the horticulture plants are in the greenhouses.
Fantastic. We hope a lot of people will take the opportunity to seek that out, and particularly today, the weather couldn't be more gorgeous for coming out and looking at plants.
I should mention that the horticulture sale benefits the horticulture club, so it allows our students to take trips and do different types of functions. And then the Wild Ones benefits, of course, the Wild Ones organization.
Very
and they
good.
Do a lot of good work, too.
Absolutely. Kate Jerome, this has been a wonderful, busy hour, and we look forward to your return visit. Thank you so much for being here today on the
pleasure.
Morning Show. Kate Jerome from the Horticulture Department here at Gateway Technical College, joining us today on the Morning Show here on WGT.